Welcome to Before the Ballot, a podcast series designed to educate voters before they cast their ballots this November. I'm your host, Elizabeth Donahue, and joining me today to discuss healthcare policy is Heather Howard. Heather is a lecturer at Princeton and director of State Health and Value Strategies. She has also served a number of roles in state and federal government, including New Jersey's Commissioner of Health and Senior Services, Associate Director of the White House Domestic Policy Council, and Policy Advisor to First Lady Hillary Clinton. She teaches courses on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and public health policy. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So through this election season, healthcare has consistently remained an important concern for voters in 2020. Going into the primary season, it is ranked as a top voter issue. What are some of the major healthcare issues that the campaigns are exploring to combat the pandemic?
Well, you're right that healthcare has always been a salient political issue for voters. And it's just, I think, become more so now as we're in the middle of the pandemic. Traditionally, I've thought about these issues as being about cost and coverage. So the cost question is that out-of-pocket costs for consumers have been growing and growing over the years, especially pharmaceutical costs. So people have been feeling it in their pocketbooks. We've also seen coverage become a very prominent issue. The Affordable Care Act reduced the number of people without health insurance dramatically, but since 2017, we've started to see that number tick up again. So we have more people without health insurance, and costs have been growing. So even people with health insurance feel like they're underinsured, meaning their own costs have been going up and they have health insurance, but they're paying more out of pocket. And then of course, what COVID has done is it's a public health crisis that has become an economic crisis. It's thrown millions of people out of work. And just last week, one study estimated that 5.4 million people have lost their health insurance because of the economic crisis. So you've got everybody thinking about their own health and the risk to their health, while at the same time, the economic crisis is worsening everyone's own financial situation.
So with COVID as the backdrop, the beginning of the primary season seems very long ago. But at the time, Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were proponents of a Medicare for All plan that would reshape entirely the healthcare industry. Can you talk a little bit about what their plans looked like in terms of structure and cost?
The big divide in the Democratic primary was whether to build on our current healthcare system, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, as it's commonly referred to, or to scrap it and build an entirely new system. And Senators Sanders and Warren fell into that latter camp. They wanted to build a universal healthcare system that was a single payer system, government run with generous benefits. And in doing so, they would be eliminating employer-sponsored insurance, which is the backbone of our current system now. More than half of all Americans now get their health insurance through their employer. And the Affordable Care Act built on that. And what Senator Sanders and Warren would have done would be to eliminate employer-sponsored insurance and put everybody into, they both call it Medicare for All. They had some differences in their system, but both would put them in a plan that they said they were modeling on the Medicare system where everybody is in one system. We didn't have this patchwork system that we have now. It would have been government funded and government run with more generous benefits than our current system has now. Both of them argued that overall the cost would be less to the system because they argued that if you put all the money that we're currently spending in our healthcare system in this fragmented way, if you put it all into one pot and use it more efficiently, you could cover everybody even with more generous benefits if we were all in one system. And Senator Sanders would point, for example, to the fact that we currently spend almost 20% of healthcare costs go to administrative costs, while under our Medicare system now, only 2% go to administration. So he argued that by eliminating those administrative costs, because you would no longer have insurance companies, you'd have a Medicare government-like, government-run system, you would save funds and be able to expand the system. The consistent question that got asked of Senator Warren was, will your taxes go up? She avoided getting called into that question by saying, look, the overall cost of the system will come down. But Senator Sanders embraced that question and said, yes, taxes may go up, but overall costs to consumers will go down because we're going to be rationalizing the system. So you had sort of different answers to the same question, but the fundamental question was, will overall costs go up and who's paying what costs? Senator Sanders argued that because you'll no longer be getting your insurance through your employer will be able to pay you higher wages. So that those were some of the key questions. And then, of course, Vice President Biden took an opposite approach, saying, let's build on our current system. He wanted to be less disruptive. He was more focused on building on the current system, not scrapping our current system in favor of a new one.
I suppose this next question is asking you to look a little bit in a crystal ball, but do you think the Biden campaign will change going forward, given that now the backdrop is COVID-19 and so many people out of work and disattached from healthcare insurance?
You've phrased it beautifully. We have a system that depends on people getting insurance through their employment, and now that's revealing the cracks in our system. As more and more people lose their jobs, tethering insurance to their employment maybe isn't so wise. And it's interesting, Vice President Biden has doubled down on his proposal, which is he's focused on expanding access to health insurance, but he's still committed to the framework of the Affordable Care Act. But he has embraced some elements. There was the unity task force between Vice President Biden and Senator Sanders and other progressive advocates have actually resulted in Vice President Biden moving to the left, and he's embraced a stronger public option, which is a government-run health insurance program to compete with private health insurance programs. So he's embraced a more ambitious public option proposal than would ever have been, I think, acceptable. President Obama supported a public option, but he couldn't get that proposal through the Senate in 2009 and 2010. So I think the center of gravity has moved to the left. And your question is the right one. Will people who might not have supported more aggressive action change now that they've seen how fragile it is to have it tethered to their employer? So we haven't seen Vice President Biden shift completely, but I think the ground on which he's working has become stronger. And if he is elected and if he is negotiating with the Congress, I think he'll be in a stronger position if he's negotiating for this public option, because I think the public is more open now to seeing ambitious proposals as being less frightening to them because they've seen how fragile their healthcare is.
So that may be the landscape, but interestingly enough, the administration is going in the opposite direction and actually filed a suit. The future of the ACA is still in the courts, as you know, with a case pending before the Supreme Court, with the administration arguing that the law should be struck down in its entirety as unconstitutional. So I'm curious to know what you think about that case and how it will have an impact on the election.
That's right. People may not realize that although the Affordable Care Act is 10 years old, it actually is still in legal jeopardy. There is a case pending before the Supreme Court now in which a number of state attorney generals are challenging the constitutionality of the law and arguing that the law should be invalidated. So here we are 10 years into the Affordable Care Act, and it's still in legal jeopardy. And we don't know when it's going to be heard. We know that briefs are being filed now, and it will, I think, be very much part of the election debate, this question of should the Affordable Care Act stay or should it be invalidated. And what's interesting is that the Trump administration has filed briefs supporting the states that have challenged the law, and they've been arguing that the law is unconstitutional and it should be invalidated. So what would that mean? That would mean they are actually, the position they've taken would invalidate the entire law, not just the individual mandate, which is the least popular part of the law and what triggered this lawsuit, but they've been arguing that the entire law should be invalidated. And so that means that repeal of many provisions of the ACA that are quite popular, including, for example, the protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And, you know, we've seen that studies estimate that between 40 and 50% of Americans have someone in their family who has a pre-existing condition. People understand what that means to have a pre-existing condition, to worry that maybe your health insurance, you might not be able to obtain health insurance because of it. And so I think we're going to see Vice President Biden raising this issue and saying the administration wants to do away with protections like that pre-existing condition. And I think it will become a bigger issue as we get closer to the election. And briefs get filed. The Supreme Court will announce their schedule for the fall. perhaps oral arguments will be held in October before the election, but even if they're not, the fact that the case is pending will elevate this question of, is the Affordable Care Act settled law, or could it be repealed by the courts in a way that, you know, the Republicans in Congress were never able to repeal it legislatively?
So putting aside sort of some of the changes that we're seeing that you just mentioned because of COVID-19, it does seem that there is a difference in the electorate between 2008 and the current campaign season in terms of the fact that, you know, the debates in 2008 and 2010 over the Affordable Care Act were quite intense and needed, the American public needed, it seems to me, a lot of convincing that it was a good idea. And now you have a sizable group, perhaps not a majority, but a sizable group supporting Medicare for All. So COVID-19 aside, do you think there's been changes in the electorate in terms of how they see healthcare policy? And if so, what has promoted those changes?
You're right. It was incredibly contentious in 2009. People will remember the summer, the August recess when members of Congress went home and held town hall meetings, and how contentious that was in 2009 as the Affordable Care Act was moving through Congress. It was signed into law in the spring of 2010, and it was immediately unpopular. And you could trace its popularity to how partisan it was. What's interesting is that over the next 10 years, we all wondered, would it become more popular or less popular? Well, today, the ACA is the most popular it's ever been. For those of us who study social policy, what we've seen is that it's become, as people have benefited personally from the law, they feel more strongly about it. I think also over the last couple of years, we've seen as Congress has tried to repeal it, and they failed, but as Congress tried to repeal it, I think that brought into sharp relief for consumers the risk of losing the Affordable Care Act, and that strengthened it. And then, you know, I think it really is we were talking earlier about pre-existing condition protections and how many people have somebody in their family member who has diabetes or is a cancer survivor. You know, people appreciate that. There are other provisions that themselves are very popular across the political spectrum. There's the provision that allows children to stay on their parents' health insurance until they're age 26. There is a provision that prevents insurance companies from capping how much healthcare you can use in your lifetime. It used to be that, for example, an insurance company could set a limit of $1 million in healthcare expenditures in your life, and that is eliminated. Those provisions all are very popular, and now that they've been in place for a number of years, people appreciate them, and they, to be honest, become baked into the social policy fabric, and it's much harder to take them away. And you've seen that in the polling as it's become more popular. The Medicaid expansion was very controversial, part of the first big challenge that went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court validated the law, but made the Medicaid expansion optional, which basically gave states choice whether or not to expand their Medicaid program, which is the program, it's a joint federal-state program for low-income people. And many states decided not to expand, but slowly over time, more states have expanded. Just this summer in Oklahoma, the voters approved expansion of Medicaid. So to me, that was quite a sign that the Affordable Care Act has become more accepted, and that people, and also, of course, that vote was coming in the middle of COVID, and people were voting for healthcare. And we're going to see later this season, the voters of Missouri are going to be voting on Medicaid expansion. And that will be another test of this theory, of course. But I really do think it comes back to, as people have been experiencing the benefits, it becomes that much harder to take it away.
That's so interesting. It seems that the Trump campaign is pitching to the electorate that its ability to reopen the economy really is more important than these stay-at-home orders, while Biden's campaign is really focused on prioritizing the pandemic. And this seems like such a binary choice. And I wondered if you could speak to it. And again, looking in your crystal ball, try to see which tactic you think will be the most successful with the electorate.
We're obviously going to see come election day, we're going to get to test this proposition. But Vice President Biden would say that if we can get the epidemic under control, then we can restart the economy, right? That it's not either or. And I've been serving on New Jersey's Restart and Recovery Commission, and that's certainly what I've seen at the state level in New Jersey. Governor Murphy has been focused on, we have to manage the pandemic, and then we can reopen the economy. because what we've seen in other states where there was not an attention focused on managing the pandemic, they started to reopen and the pandemic flared up. And now they're having to close up again. So if we can't get a handle on the pandemic, then it's going to be impossible to reopen because people will be afraid to go out. People won't be shopping. We won't be able to go to school. So they're inextricably intertwined, the health and the economy. Just like this health crisis has become an economic crisis, I believe we won't be able to address the economic crisis until we've sufficiently addressed the health crisis. In New Jersey, we've made tremendous progress because we've shut down, and I think there's been strong compliance with a lot of the state's measures, but we're not seeing that in other states. So I'm very worried.
Right. And arguably a second wave or a third wave will be more financially detrimental than getting a handle on it and then reopening carefully so that people trust and do go back to shopping and eating out and all the other things that bolster our economy.
Right. That's exactly right. We're seeing how on a macro level, the pandemic is intertwined with the economic crisis. And on a personal level, people, when they're uncertain about their health and the risks, they're not going to be the economic actors that we want them to be supporting the economy. So I do think they're inextricably intertwined. And to go back to your original question, that bet that the two campaigns are making, I think that the Trump campaign is not seeing them as intertwined, and I think they're going to regret that.
So just pivoting a little bit, another healthcare crisis that was very much in the news until COVID-19 took over all of the news ink, as you will, was the opioid crisis, which really had exposed serious health issues and serious cracks in our public health system as well. And I'm wondering about, you know, where the opioid crisis is today and whether you think that's going to have any impact on the upcoming election.
So I'm so glad you raised that because I wish people were talking about this more. I mean, the opioid crisis is an epidemic as well. Tens of thousands of people dying each year. And we have been making small progress over the last couple of years, finally, but we've seen that the COVID crisis has actually worsened the opioid crisis. We've seen so far this year that there's been a 13% increase in overdose deaths related to opioids. Here in New Jersey, the number's even higher, a 17% increase in overdose deaths. And we think that's due to, you know, I mean, it's the kind of thing that we'll be studying for years, but so far what we think is adding to it is social isolation and social isolation being a risk factor in many ways. I mean, as we know from our stellar Princeton economist, Ann Case and Angus Deaton, we've got the economic despair leading to health despair and overdoses. But we're also seeing here, if people in social isolation, if people are using drugs alone and then they're overdosing, there's nobody there to help save them. We've seen that there's been a restriction in the access to substance use treatment. So people have less access to treatment. They may be using, and social isolation may be driving greater utilization. They're driving alone, which is a risk factor for overdose. So all of these are coming together, and seeing a 13% increase this year is really, really concerning, and people aren't talking about it, and we're not focused on it. And so I'm very worried that this problem is going to worsen.
I mean, similarly, some of the reporting is that with such a focus on the crisis, a couple things are happening. One is people aren't seeking treatment for other conditions, as you noted with the opioid addictions, but also other disease and other illnesses. But we're also seeing a reduction in the number of children getting immunizations. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. That just seems like there are these sort of secondary and tertiary effects of COVID, which are unintended consequences. I don't think health officials mean to reduce immunization rates. But by sounding the alarm, you know, there are these sort of other things going on.
That's a great question. And that, of course, is one of the tremendous ironies here, is that we've got a healthcare crisis that is driving people to the hospital for care for COVID-19, but keeping people away from healthcare for traditional prevention and diagnostic and annual visits. And I think in the health policy space, we're very worried about that. as you mentioned, we've been hearing from pediatricians, and I heard this on the New Jersey Restart and Recovery Commission, that vaccines for children, which are, you know, a key part of annual wellness visits for kids, are down by more than 50%, as people have been avoiding going to the doctor for fear of being exposed to COVID. People are not getting their mammograms, they're not getting their vaccines, and we're going to see a year or years from now the results of people not taking those preventive healthcare screenings and other services that they need. A related issue is what happens to those healthcare providers. If you're a hospital, you may have been very busy with seeing COVID patients, but one of the steps that the healthcare system and has made to make sure they had enough capacity to treat patients with COVID-19 is that there's been a suspension of elective procedures at hospitals. And of course, also we're seeing this in doctor's offices as people forego those preventive services. So our healthcare system itself is at risk because they've seen a dramatic drop in volume and in usage. And again, it's a little bit hard for people to get their heads around it, but as people have been foregoing healthcare services because they're afraid to interact with the healthcare system, that means that our healthcare providers are not getting the reimbursements that they rely on. And I'm really worried about the financial solvency of healthcare providers. So those very pediatricians we're talking about that aren't providing immunizations to children at their annual well child visits are at financial risk. And Congress has reacted and Congress has appropriated funding for healthcare providers. But so far, we've been hearing from providers, and I know state officials are very worried about this, that money is not getting out quickly enough. And so I'm very worried that we're going to see financial distress and we might see healthcare providers have to go out of business because they've seen such a decline in healthcare utilization.
So just to wrap up, as in line with the name of this podcast, if I'm a voter and healthcare is my number one issue, what should I be thinking about when I go to the ballot box?
I think for voters this fall, healthcare is very much on the ballot. As we've discussed, there is a case pending before the Supreme Court now, and it'll be heard this fall, in which a number of states and the Trump administration are arguing that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Whereas Vice President Biden, of course, is arguing that he not only wants to keep the Affordable Care Act, but that he wants to build on it and expand access to health insurance. So you've got two very different policy approaches to that law. But more generally, I think you have a more philosophical difference. One is that healthcare is a right and a common good that should be provided by government. And another view that is more focused on an individual approach and individual responsibility. We, of course, see that play out. We're seeing that play out in the pandemic now in the question of mask wearing. In some places, masks are seen as a communal responsibility and are mandated by the states. In other parts of the country, it's seen as an individual question and a question of individual freedom. So I think that sort of underlying philosophical question is on the ballot as well. Is healthcare a basic right or is it an individual question?
Well, this is all very interesting and we really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today. And you please stay healthy as we go forward.
Thank you. That was a great discussion. Thanks for having me.
Go to vote.gov to register to vote in this year's election. You've been listening to Before the Ballot. This show is produced by me, Henry Barrett, with the assistance of Rose Huber. This podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs.